WBEZ is supported by Rivian. Off-road electric Joyride ride-alongs are available in downtown Chicago in a Rivian truck or SUV from September 19th to the 21st at the corner of East Illinois and North Michigan. Plus, a chance to win a two-night stay at a luxury Chicago hotel. Terms apply. No purchase necessary. Entry period is September 12th through the 21st. Must be 21 to enter. Odds of winning depend on number of entries. Visit Rivian.com/Chicago Sweepstakes to enter.
America is changing, and so is the world.
But what's happening in America isn't just the cause of global upheaval. It's also a symptom of disruption that's happening everywhere.
I'm Asma Khalid in Washington, D.C.
I'm Tristan Redman in London, and this is The Global Story.
Every weekday, we'll bring you a story from this intersection, where the world and America meet.
Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's Friday, so you know what that means. Time to catch up on what's been happening across Chicago and Illinois in our weekly news recap. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset.
We had more money during COVID and now it's gone. And here we are circling the drain again.
Chicago Public Schools is facing a $734 million budget shortfall.
What CTU and the mayor are talking about, which is, you know, providing another billion or billion six for Chicago Public Schools, that's just not going
to
happen.
Up to 8 inches of rain fell on the city on Sunday, flooding basements and damaging carpets, clothing and furniture.
Our neighbors are hurting. I've been in basements with families this week. And the damage is heartbreaking.
We'll be breaking down stories like these with CityCast Chicago executive producer Simone Alisea, Fox 32 political correspondent Paris Schutz, and WBEZ education reporter Sarah Karp. So what happened this week? Well, students headed back to class in Chicago, all while CPS is still struggling with a major budget deficit. Sarah kicked us off by talking about the main budgetary issues that the school board's grappling with.
The school district started school this year without a budget in place, which is highly unusual.
Sounds problematic.
Yeah, I mean, for two reasons. One, you know, school used to always start after Labor Day. So there was times in the past that we did have budgets passed in August, but still there was many weeks to go before school started. And, you know, right now, it's kind of a complicated situation that we're in, because on one side, the school district officials say that they have solved the budget deficit and they are ready to present a balanced budget next week. But that budget that they presented includes roughly $400 million of money from TIF surpluses, which are these special taxing districts that the city has. And, you know, it's where they put money aside for economic development projects. And CPS is expecting that the city will take out all this money and that they will get about $400 million of it. Now, they also, in the budget, says that they will pay this very controversial municipal pension payment.
Which, what's that?
This is this MEABF. I feel like if I write this one more time in a story, I'm going to lose my mind. But basically, it's a pension payment that's handled by the city, the responsibility of the city, but it includes about 60% of the pensioners are CPS employees, non-teaching CPS employees. And so, you know, starting under Mayor Lightfoot about 5 years, 4 or 5 years ago, she shifted some of the costs over to CPS, saying like, hey, these are your people, CPS should be paying for it. But it's still the city's responsibility. So it's all just this complicated mess where the CPS budget says, oh, we'll pay it, but only if we get extra money above and beyond the money that we're planning from the city and planning from the state. That's above and beyond this $400 million in TIF surplus. And so there's this whole, crazy debate about, like, will the city give us that whole $400 million if we don't promise to pay the pension payment? And that's really like the big debate right now.
And what do we do if we don't get it at all?
And what do we do if we don't get, what if then we don't, you know, get the pension payment? Should we put, some board members want there to be a possibility in the budget that CPS would take a loan if it did, if something didn't work out and they needed to take this loan in order to not avoid mid-year cuts. And other people say, you know, we shouldn't be taking on more debt because the school district is already buried in debt. So there's a lot of tension.
And they're supposed to, CPS is supposed to get this budget approved next Thursday.
They have to get it approved by next Friday. So Thursday, the meeting starts at 3 p.m. And if they don't get it approved, and let me tell you that there are, the majority of the board is saying that they will not vote for the budget that was presented by district officials last week.
Yeah.
So they want changes. They want this loan to be included, and they want this pension payment to be guaranteed. But district officials and the CEO of the school district are the ones that are responsible for presenting a budget. And I don't think that the board can unilaterally change the budget.
Mm-hmm.
So there is some tension there, but yeah, and if they don't get it approved, I think there are repercussions. I think that at some point, like, they won't be able to pay payroll, or they won't be able to do X, Y, and Z. I mean, if I'm a betting woman, they'll approve it. They'll figure out a way.
Well, I mean, say this budget standoff does continue, Paris. I mean, what do you think then is the kind of impact that we'd see on the students and the parents?
Well,
and the teachers?
Yeah, as Sarah said, they can't make payroll. I can't imagine they would be able to keep classes going and schools open in the interim. I mean, they have to have a budget. And so, I mean, I think that there's a lot of politics involved here. There's 10 members on the board that are aligned with the mayor and the Chicago Teachers Union that want CPS to make that pension payment, not the city, that also want the possibility to take out a loan to pay for that. But it's very interesting because These are positions that CTU criticized in the past. They were very critical of Mayor Lightfoot for making CPS pay that pension payment. They felt the city should pay that. Now they flipped 180. They've also been very critical of these high interest loans, all the debt that CPS has taken on, saying you've made all these Wall Street fat cats rich. Now flip the script.
Mm-hmm.
They want CPS to be able to take out those loans. And I think the contention is, well, everyone thinks that more borrowing for CPS is going to be it's going to put it in a tough position. But CTU and Mayor Johnson, this is why you've heard this constant messaging that they believe the state is short $1.6 billion in money that it owes to CPS. I don't think that's necessarily true. I think that's clever sleight of hand, and we can get into the law there. But so they're saying, well, this is a bridge loan. You know, loans are bad, but we're going to get money from the state. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you heard Governor Pritzker this week, that money's not there. You know, they're incrementally adding money every year, but they don't have $1.6 billion just to give to CPS.
Right. And the teachers union, they did rally yesterday, right, Sarah? So I assume that was some of the messaging.
Yeah, they're very upset at the governor for saying that this money is not coming to them. And, you know, it is true that it's a little sleight of hand to say that the state owes CPS $1.6 billion. But one thing that does sort of bolster the case, not only of the school board members and the CTU and the mayor, is that the state came out with its calculations on how it's going to distribute state funding. And in that, they look at how much it would take for school districts to provide an adequate education, how much state funding they should get to provide an adequate education, and how much they're actually getting. And that difference is $1.557 million or something like that. So it's about $1.6 billion. That's why they round up, right? So, yes, it is true. Like, owes is a little bit of a sleight of hand. The state did make a commitment in 2017-2018 when they put this funding formula in place that they would get everybody at 90% adequacy by 2027, which is, you know, not too far in the distance. And, you know, instead of moving closer to adequacy, not just Chicago Public Schools, but about 300 school districts in the state move further away from adequacy.
Okay.
And so that's, you know, that is an issue, because this adequacy is really just like the minimum that schools would need in order to provide, you know, basically enough social workers and counselors and teachers and things like that. And so, you know, I do think that there's there is an argument there, not just for CPS, but for school districts across the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no question. And that's right. And 90%, the goal was 90%
right, so
of adequacy
1. 1 billion.
By 2027, although the law doesn't mandate that. It's more like an aspirational goal, correct? I mean,
They said that this is what they want to do.
This is mm-hmm. what they want to do. At the same time, CPS does get, when you look at funding per pupil, I mean, it's around, $30,000? Mm-hmm. So commensurate to other school districts, it's not a poor level of funding. I mean, again, a lot of that's coming from right. local property taxes.
So on that point, though, of Governor Pritzker, as you said earlier, Paris, saying, like, we just don't have the funding.
Right.
How is Mayor Johnson responding to that, the fact that the state is seemingly unwilling to provide more money?
Well, it's not that they're unwilling. Governor Pritzker has said, like, hey, I agree, we should provide this money, but we have our
He's
own.
He's saying we can't.
We can't.
We can't bail you out.
The money's not there. But I got to bring up the point that lawmakers have been very frustrated with the mayor and with CTU because they'll say that despite the constant claims in the media to give us this funding, they haven't actually gone down to Springfield to meet one-on-one and lobby for this and to state their case and build up a coalition. And there's some lawmakers, Chicago lawmakers, that would be normally allied with them, like Curtis Tarver, who's very critical. He's like, all you're doing is antagonizing us. You're antagonizing the governor. You're antagonizing Springfield. You're saying it's Springfield's fault. If you really wanted to solve this, you wouldn't antagonize us. You'd come down and you'd get a coalition of school districts, which they're starting to do now.
Yeah.
And we'd all hammer out the details and solve this, but that's not what's happening. And that's where you have to talk about politics. In 2026, there's going to be 20 elected school board races,
yes,
and everyone's gearing up for that.
Yeah. Well, Simone, guess what? It's not just Chicago schools with money troubles. We got some West suburban districts that are also facing budget battles. Teachers are back in the classroom, but without contracts. What's going on?
Yeah. So in River Forest, teachers there are without a contract. And then most pressingly, I think in Naperville, which has set a date for a strike. Teachers there planning to strike starting on Tuesday.
Oh boy.
Having been without a contract, I think they've been in negotiations since February. We've got federal mediators involved in that, or federally mandated mediators involved in that. And, you know, the issues in both districts, in River Forest and Naperville, it's the issue everywhere. It's pay, it's salary, it's, mm-hmm. you know, benefits, days off. It's you know, those classic, union issues. And so, you're right. It's not just Chicago that is sort of dealing with, obviously we just got our own contract, mm-hmm. right, earlier this spring with Chicago Teachers Union that the district is figuring out how to pay for mm-hmm. as part of all this budgeting effort. But it's rippling out into other communities as
just
well.
It feels like the story across the country. I'm seeing it happen in other regions, too. So we had relentless rain, which was causing flooding throughout the area on Monday night. Northwest Suburban Cary declared a state of emergency. Highways flooded, service was suspended on the CTA Purple Line, and ground stops were ordered at O'Hare and Midway, which resulted in flight delays as well as cancellations. Now, on Chicago's southwest side, the mayor accompanied alders. They were visiting homes where basements were flooded. Things were pretty bad, rough shape, Simone. Tell us about the kind of help that these politicians, though, are hoping to bring.
It's interesting because I think there's a couple different things going on here. You know, you mentioned those disaster proclamations. That stuff can come with aid, but, you know, it's very slow. There are still people, if you remember the floods in 2023, there are still people who are recovering from those floods, right? But it's interesting because I think now we're starting to see even more talk and sort of more gearing up about just addressing the base problem, which is Chicago's aging sewer system, right? Our sewer system is very old. It mm-hmm. was a marvel of engineering when it was built in, 150 years ago or so. But now it causes major problems. And I think there is going to be even more scrutiny on, I think under Mayor Rahm Emanuel, there was a big, water sewer rates went up, right? And the whole idea was to like remake the sewer system.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's going to be, with these continued rains and floods, I think there's going to be even more scrutiny on like, okay, well, where are we on that? Where is that getting built? Particularly on the south and west sides where this flooding is most prevalent because the infrastructure is just that much weaker. It's just that much more prevalent,
so
more
the city's, likely. So the city's talking about then introducing dozens of flood sensors.
Yeah, so this is another thing that's going on is working with a startup called Hi-Fi, I think out of Michigan, and Verizon. And there's this plan to install a bunch of flood sensors that use sonar to basically, the idea is twofold. A, to sort of get data about where flooding is most likely to happen so that, you know, if you're going to do infrastructure, if you're going to do maintenance, you know, you can
target.
Exactly, target the spots. But also it can theoretically be a helpful thing for emergency services. Theoretically, these sensors can, you know, sense floods beginning to happen before they get so serious.
Yeah,
so
maybe as water levels rise, it can detect it and then sort of create these like real-time flood maps.
Yes, yes.
What do you all think, Sarah and Paris? Long time coming, or is it sort of seeming impossible at this point? It's supposed to happen over the next 18 months. I don't know.
Believe it when I see it. I mean, you know, it's a shame that these residents have suffered, like especially in the south east and southwest side. And I know that there are aldermen right now that are, you know, this is the tough job now, is to like have everybody report their damage to so that they can get FEMA and federal reimbursement money. And now with like the Trump administration and FEMA kind of on the chopping block, how is that money going to be available? I mean, I talked to actually there are a couple school board members that had their basement. Olga Bautista, she was dealing with flooding and they can't afford.
Yeah,
those costs are wild.
This is wild.
Right? Like it's thousands
that,
of dollars.
They need that reimbursement, and it's incumbent upon reporting that to the city, so the city and to your congressperson, so that they can get an accurate assessment of how much federal money needs to come in. And what happened to the deep tunnels
I was just going to say that. That's what I would say. I think they've been talking about those, about you know rebuilding the sewer system. I mean, forever. Like, I feel like one of the first stories that I did, like coming out of college, and I worked for the Daily Southtown, was about like flooding and you know how they needed to rebuild the sewer system. I mean, it's a massive project, and it seems like the sensors might be helpful, but I mean, it's sort of like alerting people to a flood, but sure. It doesn't really like prevent the flood.
I'm also kind of surprised we don't already have this data.
I was just about to say that.
That's always the thing with
to
these.
To hear Sarah say how long we've been talking about this, I'm like, really? And this is, we're only at this point?
Well, and I have a suspicion what we're going to learn is there's a lot of flooding on the south and west sides.
Oh, really?
And I'm surprised. That's where the infrastructure money needs to go.
Before we take a pause, gang, let's stick with water for just a moment. There's growing concern that AI, artificial intelligence, may be depleting our drinking water. Make sense of this one, Simone.
I mean, so here's the thing. AI relies on data centers, and there are a lot of these popping up around the country, especially popping up in Illinois. And these data centers require water to cool them. They're using a lot of process. You know how hot your computer gets, right?
Yes.
Imagine that on scale, right?
Right.
It's getting really, really hot. They need lots of water to cool. Various states around the Great Lakes, including Illinois, have said, hey, one of the reasons you should come build your data center is because we got a lot of water that we can cool those servers down with. A new report estimates that these large data centers are expected to use more than 150 billion gallons of water across the U.S. over the next 5 years. It's enough water to supply 4.6 million homes.
Sounds like we're going to be on the losing end of that.
Well, and you know, I know that Chicago officials want to attract those data centers here, but there's talk about taxing them and raising revenue because of all the. It's not just water, but also power,
our energy,
and that's just going to drive up everybody's costs. So they're
it's already driving up costs.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Oh yeah, my energy bills for June, July, August, and I'm baffled. I'm baffled.
Oh, it's downstate. It's Chicago. It's the suburbs.
Oh, my goodness. My jaw dropped when I saw that. It was just going up like over $100
each month.
And
what they're saying is it's because of the prevalent use of AI and AI becoming more common and needing to draw on all this energy. And I think the other thing about like attracting those businesses, to Paris's point, is the other thing though is we don't have a lot of transparency into the agreements that these companies are making with governments about how much water they get to use. We have a little bit more about the energy, but when it comes to water, it's kind of a black hole. We don't really, really know.
Yeah. Paris, Governor Pritzker signed more than 260 bills into law last Friday. Walk us through all 260 of them.
Well, it must be a very sore wrist right now. That's a lot of penmanship and John Hancock's. But let's pick out a couple. I think there's one that's very interesting, and that is the Citizen Participation Act. He's strengthening basically protections for journalists and any kind of public citizens to be able to get data and get information on public officials and what they're doing without fearing retaliation. Mm. Obviously, at the federal level, we've got a lot of worries about how the Trump administration wants to go after journalists. But here, Pritzker's saying we're going to strengthen protections for journalists so that, public officials can't just come, try and sue you or something for your reporting. It's in the public interest to report things about public officials that might not be so positive and so favorable. So that's an interesting one. Mm-hmm. I think another interesting one that's gotten a lot of debate, and this bubbled up after it was signed, and that's mental health screenings in public schools in Illinois. And basically, it's requiring the State Board of Education to come up now with this framework to administer mental health screenings for public school students from, I believe, third grade through 12th grade.
Yeah.
And this is something that mental health advocates and public education advocates have wanted for a long time. The idea is to be able to, have good outcomes for students. So if you know that one student is dealing with ADD or some other issue, you can tailor your education to them. It started to get pushback after it was signed from parents saying, we don't want the schools to be in the business of diagnosing our children.
Yeah.
And now parents can opt out of this. They can opt out of having their kids do this. I think there's a valid criticism to say, we don't know a lot about how the state wants to go about doing this. The bill just kind of was very vague. It doesn't even say whether physicians are going to conduct the screenings. It's leaving a lot to the Board of Education to determine. And then, of course, there's some fear mongering, I think, saying, hey, it's big brother, big government going to diagnose your kid and put them on meds. Like, I don't think educators can put your kids on medication.
A lot for parents to consider. Yeah. Right. Sarah, what do you think?
Well, I wanted to say that last year, maybe it was 2 years ago, me and Kristen Shorsch, a reporter here, did a whole story about looking at crisis mental health services for youth in Illinois. And one thing that we found is that a lot of school districts are doing this type of screening already, especially suburban school districts. And the idea is, they're pretty general surveys, but they sort of get at, are you feeling super depressed, or are there other things that are, really troubling you? And at least in these suburban school districts, they handed that information over to the mental health people in the school, whether it was a social worker or a counselor, and then they would refer kids to services. I think one of the other big questions here, though, is that there is a real lack of mental health services for youth in Illinois. And, just really, really hard to get, times with therapists. Mm-hmm. I mean, even in affluent communities, there's a long waiting list. And then in less affluent communities, it's almost non-existent. I mean, we documented, kids having to go into, several towns and having for hospitals, having to, travel, far away from their homes to get needed services. And so, we're going to screen all these kids.
Yeah.
It's not going to be so great if we found out, hey, this kid is really, really depressed, but we don't really have much to do for them, And so I think that does beg the question. I mean, it's one thing to know. It's kind of like the sensors for the floods. Like we know you're flooded, but we don't know we don't know what we're going to do about that. And so I think that that's sort of the next step. Like, well, okay, now what?
Yeah. Let's turn to some other politics, Simone. Democratic Texas lawmakers, they have returned home from Illinois. And just as expected, the Texas state legislature approved a new electoral map that favors Republicans. I mean, do you have any thoughts? And you too, Paris, you can weigh in on just what impact their walkout had.
I think it's about the visibility, right? I think that's with something like that, it's always about rallying it, not just as this isn't just a local state issue about redistricting. This is a national, we're sounding a national alarm to try to say, hey, this is very abnormal. This is weird. This is, shouldn't really be happening this way. I do think what's been interesting has been the response from Democratic governors, right? Particularly, you know, Gavin Newsom in California. This idea of like, oh, well, maybe we'll go tit for tat. We'll do some redistricting too. And you have Pritzker over here saying, you know, quote, I think it was like everything's on the table. Nothing's off the table. It was something like that. But you know, I don't know how many more seats state Democrats are going to be able to get, even if they were to do some out of time redistricting.
Yeah, I know the Texas lawmakers, they couldn't hold out forever, right? And I think that their rationale for going back and saying, hey, we accomplished our mission, is that Gavin Newsom in California picked up the baton. So they raised awareness. Gavin Newsom now taking action to put new maps on their ballot for the public to vote on that would perhaps conceivably equal out the advantage Texas is trying to get for Republicans. And, you know, gerrymandering is a very important topic. We've covered this
for years.
It's hard to get the public on board, but now when to pay attention to something that this is fundamental, but now it's so in your face, and it is unusual that Texas is doing this midstream. It's supposed to happen every 10 years after the census. They've made no bones about this is to help Trump. This is to help Republicans nationally to keep power.
Quite literally at his request.
At his request. Right. They're not hiding that, so we don't need to guess what their motives are. It hurt the message to come to Illinois, which is a state on the other side that got an F from the government groups for its gerrymandering, and Democrats drew maps here to benefit Democrats as much as they could. So to Simone's point, I don't know how much more they could really help Democrats here, but this arms race on gerrymandering is if you care about democracy and representative government, it's a tragedy. Mm. It's going to hurt. It's going to make everything more partisan and extreme. It's going to really dilute representative government, where politicians are now picking their voters. This is not good.
Yeah.
And Pritzker and Newsom, to their credit, are admitting that this is not good. But we can't, in an arms race, just disarm now.
Yeah.
We need to match fire with fire, and then there has to be a uniform national standard to have districts that are drawn without politics in mind, without trying to just benefit one party over the other.
Well, that's the other wild thing, right? Every state has their own process that they just make up for how they want to draw districts.
Yeah, and that's going to dovetail into our discussion about mail-in voting. You know, the Constitution gives the states the power to run elections and to do these things, and that's where the Constitution says the power lies. And now with mail-in voting and stuff, the president is saying
he wants to ban it
with an executive order. He can't legally. You can't. The Constitution's pretty clear. It gives the states and state legislatures the power to make these rules. The president can't, with an executive order, just decide, no thanks.
So you don't think it can happen? Not realistic?
Well, I mean, the judges have made rulings here, but it hasn't stopped the president from, by executive fiat, coming up with things that are blatantly not under his purview to do. So who's going to stop him? You know, governors will say, no, we're not going to. We get to have mail-in voting if that's what we decide here. There's some states that have universal mail-in voting. And by the way, that's not a partisan thing. It's Republicans have benefited from mail-in voting. Democrats have benefited from it. It's just that Trump has decided that it's somehow...
He's never liked it.
He's never liked
from
it.
From the beginning. He thinks it's
Even
evil.
Though, hey, let's not kid ourselves. Trump voted absentee. He voted mail-in, you know, in the last two elections. So rules for thee, not for me.
Right. Let's shift gears a little bit here, Simone. Attorney General Kwame Raoul. Well, really, this all comes back to Trump, actually. So let me scratch that.
Everything comes back to Trump.
Let's scratch what I just said.
True.
So Raoul is suing the Trump administration yet again. What is it for this time, though?
This time we're talking about funds that are due to Illinois under the Federal Victims of Crime Act. And so basically a policy was put out that said that, states that have rules, laws on the books that, prohibit them from coordinating with immigration enforcement, they don't get to get these funds. And Raoul is among many states that have said, no, we still are entitled to this money. You can't actually do that. This is an unlawful condition that you've imposed on the distribution of these funds. And these are funds that go to victims of crime to deal with the costs associated with that. Anything from, any like material repairs you might need to make to, like, if you're the victim of a home invasion, for example, that you might need to fix medical bills, counseling services, things like that, lost wages. It's something like $54 million on the block here for Illinois. But, really, this is just yet another sort of example of Trump wanting to make an example of states and cities that have so-called sanctuary city policies. Mm-hmm. You know, we're targeting the States Trust Act here, which basically says that, you know, the government officials, police, et cetera, unless there is an actual warrant, a criminal warrant, or there's criminal info, you know, that they don't have to coordinate or actually participate in immigration enforcement.
Yeah.
So we've seen example after example of this in threats and in attempted, action, but much of that is tied up in the courts.
And this has been litigated over and over and ruled on. I mean, in the first Trump administration, they tried to do the same thing. The city of Chicago sued and won. And judges universally said, you can't withhold this federal money on that condition, that saying you don't like that they're sanctuary cities. The sanctuary stuff has been litigated, and now different judges might have different interpretations.
But a different federal bench these days.
Different federal bench. But overwhelmingly, the state and the city have been found to be in compliance with the law to be able to have these, they call it, these sanctuary policies, the Trust Act and the Welcoming City Ordinance, where, again, you know, it's not illegal to say that your local law enforcement is barred from cooperating with federal immigration raids unless there's a criminal warrant, and in that case they do cooperate, and there's all kinds of cooperation that does happen. So again, maybe a different judge will rule differently,
right.
But this has been litigated over and over, and the city keeps winning, but the Trump administration keeps trying to find ways to wrestle these sanctuary laws off the books when, again, this is an issue with the state and the city.
And with stuff like this, I always wonder, like, what stuff is now the Illinois Attorney General, that the city's, you know, legal officers, what are they not working on because they have to deal with this that has already been litigated, that we've already won lawsuits on?
I mean, the overarching narrative is that the Trump administration, their ideology and their belief is in a powerful executive branch and a powerful federal government now. It's a reversal from Republicans that believed in states' rights.
Yeah.
The Trump administration believes in usurping states' rights and saying, nope, we have the power here to determine your laws.
Yeah, let's go to a couple other stories here from Springfield. Lawmakers are on break right now, but three legislators want a special session called to deal with transit funding. Yesterday, the RTA, the Regional Transit Authority, they voted to transfer $74 million from Metra and PACE to the CTA. Get us up to speed there on transit funding, Simone.
Right. So I'm sure listeners have heard plenty about this $771 million fiscal cliff across all three agencies, Metra, PACE, CTA, and the overarching Regional Transit Authority. But CTA is sort of the most likely to feel that most quickly, you know, and predicting cuts as soon as September that they might have to potentially put out some pink slips.
Wow.
So that $74 million that you just talked about that was just passed by the RTA to like kind of move that money around the three agencies, that was basically to kind of stave off like, hey, this gives lawmakers another 2 to 3 months for them to figure out what they're going to do about this larger fiscal cliff on the agenda. And you have lawmakers who are saying, you know, we need to do this now because this is becoming so close for the CTA. Like, we can't even wait. You know, we have the fall veto session coming up in October.
The clock is ticking.
The clock is ticking. And I think a lot of us thought like, hey, maybe you'll get to this when you were there in the spring and y'all were we're all talking about this. We knew it was coming. And we're really, really getting down to the wire. And, you know, CTA is sort of saying they're sounding alarm. They're talking about 40% service cuts across the board.
Yep. Bus and train lines gone.
Yeah, I have a feeling, you know, Springfield lawmakers have basically been like, I think we need to change the governance overall of regional transit, right? And they've been really adamant about this, you know, sort of no additional funding without a change in governance. I think for those of us who ride the CTA, I think we're just like, please just do anything. I suspect a mixture of things going on.
Here, let's bring up the political aspect of this. Contrast this with the situation with public schools. Lawmakers and the governor are pretty optimistic that they're going to get a deal that could provide $1.5 billion for PACE, CTA, and Metra that could really not only plug this fiscal cliff, but make the systems run better. Like there are a lot of folks that want this to be like Europe or Berlin or wherever, where the trains come every 5-6 minutes. They want that here, and they want Metra coordinated with the CTA. And this is where transit agencies and lawmakers have been working together and pounding the pavement for a long time. Mm-hmm. And they might come up with a deal. They're on the same page. Not with the whole CPS issue. So the governor and lawmakers how they're going to pay for it. They've talked about rideshare taxes and taxes on food delivery like Grubhub. Now that stalled in the spring session. So I don't know if those...
So it's sounding to you more likely that they will come up with a transit funding solution?
Most lawmakers, they're more motivated even to. Republicans are motivated, some Republicans, because, you know, transit's important to the burbs.
Kind of crazy to contrast that with schools. The schools are important too.
Of course they are.
They're important. But there is a big difference.
I get your point though, Paris.
It is a big difference though, because one of the things about the state of Illinois is that our biggest funding source for schools is property taxes. Mm-hmm. And so the wealthier areas are not suffering like the not wealthy areas, and the not wealthy areas don't have as much power as the wealthy areas. So this is the contrast. And I mean, you know, there is a lot of, you know, hand-wringing about what happened over the last 2 years. I mean, certainly the whole mess with like Pedro Martinez and the whole sort of discussion about the whole MEABF, this municipal potential payment, it's like sucks so much time and energy that it's, you know, maybe they did not get quick enough to this, you know, ask that there needs to be something more sustainable for schools, just like for transit. I mean, they're talking about, you know, various sort of creative taxes for transit. And, you know, is there something like that for education? I mean, the state of Illinois funds education at we're 35 out of 50. So we're not doing so great. Now, we used to be 49 out of 50. So I guess we're better, but we're not so great. And, you know, if we're a state that really believes in educating, like Pritzker says, and educating all our citizens and giving them a good chance, I think that, you know, being 35 out of 50 is not probably the place where we want to be.
And the point of that, true, and most policy experts believe that a reliance on property taxes for education is bad. But it doesn't mean that more money total is going to come to these districts. The idea is to reduce the reliance on local property taxes. In Chicago, we're paying 54-55%.
That's also the difference, though, in trying to reform each of these things, right? The funding mechanism is fundamentally different for schools than it is for transit, right? Yeah, and so trying to reform that entire funding mechanism is going to take a lot more work.
And for education is being reformed. You mentioned, Sarah, the 2017 law. They realized that, I mean, that's when Illinois was 49th. Right. That's gotten better because of that bill. And transit funding has to come from the state too. You can't rely on property taxes. It's the same kind of situation. Transit impacts everybody. Yeah. You know, traffic. No one likes to sit in traffic.
Absolutely.
Whether you're in Barrington or you're in Englewood.
Wait, anywhere. Now, Sarah, a couple more stories from the school district here. A gun was found on the first day of school at a Chicago high school.
Right. This is Whitney Young High School, which is one of the city's top selective high schools on the near west side. And I guess what happened was the young person, a 15-year-old, was arrested for bringing a gun to school. And I don't think that it got past the front door. They said that it was found during, you know, standard entry practices, which I would guess was a metal detector. But one of the things that I was thinking is that, you know, a lot of selective enrollment schools don't use their metal detectors as much as some other schools. Mm-hmm. And I guess on the first day they were using it, and they did catch this. And
thank goodness they were.
Right. And I mean, we don't know, you know, what the intention of this young person was, and hopefully it was, you know, not terrible intentions. So.
I can't wrap my mind around choosing to pack your bag, lay out your outfit, your shoes, and throw that gun in your bag for the first day. I don't know. I want to turn from high school to the youngest CPS student, Sarah. You reported this story. It involved a kindergartner. What happened to her?
So this is a really hard story to report. This little girl, she's autistic. She does not speak. She went to kindergarten on her first day. She goes to a specialty kindergarten. And she was on the bus for about an hour and a half, which is way more than she should have been on the bus. And It was really hot on the bus. It was not air conditioned, I guess. And she got so overheated that she had to go to the ER. And, you know, then her the thing that was sort of surprising is that her mother, of course, very upset, called Chicago Public School Transportation. And they told her that in order to get an air conditioned bus, you have to have it written in your individualized education plan. You know, they do not have air conditioned bus for everybody. And even to make sure that your child gets water, that I guess that can't happen because there's like guidelines that say that
it's a safety hazard.
Yeah, it's a safety hazard, which is
to give them something to drink on the because the bus rides are they're bumpy.
They're bumpy, and I guess. But the other thing though
it's
is
a choking hazard. They say
if you have a bottle of water, you can drink it. It's just that you know they don't want to offer it maybe to kids who are medically fragile. In this case, this little girl could have drank water with no problem. It's just that she, you know, was not able to say, I need water. So, you know, and
very sad.
Yeah, it's very sad. And I think it sort of shows, you know, this, you talk about, well, why don't we have air conditioned buses? They're, you know, school starting earlier. August 18th is way earlier than we used to start. Yeah. And, you know, so it's, you're subjected to heat perhaps. And,
yeah, just knowing that you have to, as you said, it should be in the IEP that you need.
Right,
the
and
child
the mother was like,
"I
never even thought I had to ask for that." Like, yeah. So it's you know, it's almost like someone needs to tell you if your child needs this, ask for it.
That's pretty crazy. Let's turn to something very different here. Football. Former Northwestern coach Pat Fitzgerald reached a settlement with the university. Quickly take us back 2 years. What was the lawsuit about, Paris?
Well, it came from players or former players that alleged that he had led and presided over a massive hazing kind of scheme there where there were some, you know, really bad, even sexual kind of abuse things that were happening as part of hazing.
And he says he knew nothing about it.
He got fired. He said he knew nothing about it. And so they won't disclose the terms of the settlement. But, you know, clearly he sued for lots of money, tens of millions of dollars.
$130 million.
Okay, $130 million. I don't know if that's what he got, but you know, and he walks away saying, you know, admits the hazing was going on, but he did not know anything about it. That contradicts what the player said. The player said he full on knew about it, that he gave signals, you know, on the sideline that indicated, okay, this player's going to go get hazed right now. He denies all of that. I don't know that we'll ever know what's in that settlement. And he does walk away saying the hazing happened, but he didn't know about it.
Yeah. Simone, let's turn now to the Bears as we're talking about football. It's preseason right now. I'm curious though if it seems like the Bears are completely committed to that Arlington Heights stadium at this point. Is that where we are?
It certainly seems like it. I mean, you had Bears leadership quite literally sort of publicly committing to it, you know, on a national stage, but also you have, you know, they're also talking to state, going back to what's going on in Springfield. They're talking to state lawmakers about trying to get some property tax breaks.
That uphill battle to get some money from the state.
And here's another example where, though, they have, like, lawmakers come in and they have said over and over again, I haven't met with George McCaskey, the chairman. Democrats and Republicans alike are saying this, that they haven't done the work. And they went out in the media, Kevin Warren, the president, saying, well, we're going to hope to get this in the veto session where you need a 3/5 majority. They don't have those votes. It's not there. It could happen next year where the threshold
gets
lower.
I cannot imagine in the, 2 weeks that they have for the veto session that this is high
up
on their agenda.
No, transit is on their agenda, not this. They all say a stadium's not our agenda. I think, though, at some point something will happen. It's just not going to be this year, as the Bears are saying.
Yeah. Let's turn to fun stuff. I'm over it. If you're going down to Millennium Park, you might stumble across a new group of protesters. They're all clad in black. They call themselves the Man in the Bean Coalition. Simone, who are these people and what do they want?
Sasha, there's a man in the bean.
There's
a man in the bean.
Inside the bean.
What?
So he's been there. So this is what this coalition says. They are protesting. They want the man in the bean, quote unquote, to be released. They say that he was put there as a baby by the artist, Anish Kapoor, and that he's been fed through a tube and he's been growing in there, and that there's a man stuck inside the bean, and they are calling for the man's release.
Is this like the man in the moon?
Yes, it is. It is like the birds aren't real thing. Yeah,
I don't know. It reminded me of Balloon Boy. Remember Balloon Boy?
We've investigated it. It's not true.
There's no man in the bean, yes. For the record.
Wait,
just,
what?
It's a very big investigation. Mean?
Although that makes us part of Big Bean Media, Sarah, for saying that.
Yes, the elites
would have you believe there's no man in the bean, but we know better.
The Man in the Bean Coalition, though? The NBC?
So it's interesting because we were just looking up who they follow on Instagram, and they don't follow that many people on Instagram, and turns out the people they follow are a bunch of performers and comedians around Chicago.
No, I thought you were going to say they follow like WBEZ or Petty Cash.
No, they follow Anish Kapoor and then a bunch of performers who look very similar to
the
pictures of some of the protesters. So
yeah, fun stuff. But yeah, Paris, you just heard about this for the first time, didn't you?
I'm obsessed. I'm going down the rabbit hole now.
Yeah.
Goodbye, everybody.
Backwards. Bye.
Let's tune in at 4, 5, and 9 for the latest on the man and the bee.
So we're towards the end of the summer, folks. I know we had a couple of chilly days in there, but the sun and the heat, they're back this weekend. It's supposed to be 80s plus. Anyone got cool plans?
So many good plans.
Do you really, Sarah? Oh my gosh, look at you having a life.
I know. I'm shocked. tonight I'm going to go to Trinity Church on the far south side. They had their jazz fest tonight.
Oh, nice.
Super excited about going. Liz Wright is going to sing, who's one of my favorite singers.
Trinity Church. Oh, I love this.
And then tomorrow evening, I'm going to go see the Black Legacy Dance Project has their concert at the Harris Theater. And afterwards, I might go join Simone at the House Music Fest.
Yeah.
So I think it's just like so much fun stuff.
That's a lot. Sarah, you're going to be partied
out. I'm
going to
be tired. I think I'm going to take off Monday.
I was just going to say, if I see you strolling in here on Monday looking a little, I'll know why.
Yeah.
Blame it on Liz. Right. Yeah. What about you, Simone? Any recommendations for folks listening, things to do this weekend?
House Music Fest is a great one. Millennium Park, Grant Park, also the Cultural Center. I think they've got events today and tomorrow. Another one I want to plug because I want people to go and then tell me about it is Pizza City Fest. Mm.
Steve Dolinsky.
Yes, yeah, Steve Dolinsky, a.k.a. the food guy, a.k.a. the Hungry Hound.
Yes,
this is the third time they're putting on. They skipped last year because in 2023, there were headlines comparing it to the Fyre Festival. I don't know if it was quite that bad, but that first day was really rough. We talked to him actually on the show, and he says this is a redemption story. He's like, if it doesn't, third time's a charm or it's over. That was the idea. So if it doesn't work this year, so I need people to go to tell me if it works this year.
Until I get a press release next year telling me that Pizza City Fest is back.
Pizza City Fest is back. We'll see.
Paris, what are you up to?
I think I'm going to join Sarah and Simone at the House Music Fest for a bit. That sounds like a lot. It's Millennium Park.
Yes, so you can see the man and the bean.
And we can see the man. I'm going to invite the man and the bean to come dance to some house music with me.
Sarah just told us that it's not true, Paris.
No, come on. We're going to investigate this. But also, I'll throw a plug out for, how about Taste of Greek Town? I think that's going on this weekend.
Yes.
Get some souvlakis and some spanakopitas on Halsted over in Greek Town.
There's a new restaurant opening, too, out there.
Oh, really?
Or is about to open.
Okay. Oh, nice.
I have heard tell.
That is what I'll do. Because, you know, as you were talking, I was looking through my own personal calendar to see what can I add to this conversation. And the dang thing is empty because I have no life and I have no plans.
I'm literally just looking at the City Cash Chicago events page. I have it pulled up right now.
So I'm
now.
Going to the House Music Fest and Taste of Greek?
Yeah, Greek Town. Taste of Greek Town, I think. Yeah.
Doing it. Our thanks to Paris Schutz of Fox 32, Simone Alisea of City Cash Chicago, and WBEZ's Sarah Karp. That's it for the weekly news recap. Have a great weekend, folks.
Hey, thanks.
Thanks.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guffman, edited by Daniel Tucker, and mixed by Micah Yasin. Reset helps keep you in the loop with all things happening in our area. From politics to culture, we get you covered. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Have a great weekend, and we'll meet again soon.